we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
What does it say about a culture that is willing to completely abdicate the scientific rules to sacrifice and experiment on its own youngest children? That is what we're going to be addressing today with today's podcast about this recent, last week's approval of the vaccine, as they call it, a vaccine for young children. Not once, not twice, but three jabs. Thank you for joining us today. Jordan, that's the question. What do you think?
Yeah, Stuart, thanks for being here. It's pretty amazing to think that we have a scientific community and a regulatory community, I guess, as well as a medical industrial kind of complex that is targeting the youngest among us for a intervention for a emergency that doesn't exist in any of these age groups, but utilizing the term emergency to make sure they get something that is untested, unproven in this age group. And in all honesty, we now know doesn't even work in the age group that there might be an emergency, which would be the older individuals. But even that emergency continues to be what I would say reinitiated or re-upped. But the reality is that emergency itself also is in our past. So I think that's the biggest problem, is why do the regulators and our administrative state see no problem in giving children, the youngest among us, 6 months up to 5 years old? It's bad enough 5 to 18, but from 6 months to 5 years old, that's one of the most dynamic times. And if the study itself, when it was inadequate and was not only that, surprising to the people doing it when they gave two injections, and the FDA actually asked Pfizer and Moderna to consider adding a third before they published their data. What is going on in our regulatory and medical community that it's almost like they have to get this shot out regardless of the benefit and really regardless of the risk?
No question about it. And Jordan, I want to take a pause. And for anybody that's been on the other side of the fence on this issue than we have, when you listen to this clip we're about to play and you pause and say, what are we doing? We just want you to understand we're inviting you to dialogue. Join us. Work through your frustrations and the deceptions that you have bought into, but get engaged on our side so that we can hopefully impact our country to save these young children and the rest of our culture from the destruction, the nihilism that the people have been putting into action the last 2 years. Really, they've been planning on it for decades, but that they have actioned that plan for the last two or more years.
So with that, we will have Dr. Claire Craig presentation here. It is available.
I'm Dr. Claire Craig. I'm a diagnostic pathologist and I'm co-chair at the Heart Group. And I want to take you through the evidence that Pfizer just presented to the FDA on the 6 months to four-year-old children. There's an awful lot about this trial that has shocked me and I think will shock you too. The trial recruited 4,526 children aged from 6 months to 4 years old. 3,000 of these children did not make it to the end of the trial. That is a huge number, two-thirds of them. Why was there this drop-off? That needs to be answered. And without an answer to that, on that basis alone, this trial should be deemed null and void. So what did the trial show? Well, they defined severe COVID as children who had a slightly raised heart rate or a few more breaths per minute. There were six children aged 2 to 4 who had severe COVID in the vaccine group, but only one in the placebo group. So on that basis, the likelihood that this vaccine is actually causing severe COVID is higher than the likelihood that it isn't. There was actually one child who was hospitalized in this trial. They had a fever and a seizure. They had been vaccinated. So now let's turn to what they defined as any COVID. And what they did was to utterly twist the data. They vaccinated the children and they waited 3 weeks after the first dose before the second dose. In that 3 week period, 34 of the vaccinated children got COVID and only 13 in the placebo group, which worked out as a 30% increased chance of catching COVID in that 3 week period if you were vaccinated. So they ignored that data. And then there was an 8 week gap between the second dose and the third dose, where again, children were getting plenty of COVID in the vaccine arm. So they ignored that data. There was then 7 weeks after the third dose, which they also ignored, which meant that in the end, they had ignored 97% of the COVID that occurred during the trial. And they just looked at tiny numbers, so tiny. In the end, they were comparing 3 children in the vaccine arm who had COVID with 7 in the placebo arm. And they said that this showed the vaccine was effective. So they measured how many of these children actually managed to catch COVID twice in the 2 month follow-up period. And there were 12 children who had COVID twice, and all but one of them were vaccinated, mostly with 3 doses. So you have to wonder what on earth they're thinking when the claim of reduction in COVID was only 4 children. And here we have 12 children who got COVID twice, 11 of them vaccinated. So let's just recap. They recruited 4,500 children, 3,000 of them dropped out. And in the end, they're claiming this vaccine works on the basis of 3 COVID cases versus 7, a difference of 4 children only. And all of this on a backdrop of a disease which doesn't affect children, and with no long-term safety data. We have to ask how an ethics committee could have approved this trial in babies. Babies are not at risk from COVID. And now we have Pfizer, who are presenting this as evidence to the FDA in order to apply for an emergency use authorization. Emergency use authorization is meant for a situation where there's a risk of serious injury or death. Now, children under 5 are not at risk of serious injury or death from COVID. In fact, in their own trial, they had to make up other ways of measuring the problem because there was no serious injury or death. Now, originally, these products were sold as actually also reducing transmission. Now, it would be completely unethical to use young children as a human shield, but we now know that they don't reduce transmission. The WHO have stopped claiming and they reduce transmission, so that argument doesn't apply either. Now, if we just turn to safety, what they did is they followed up the patients for 6 weeks before unblinding them and vaccinating them. So the children who'd had placebo, the control group, were followed up for an average of 6 weeks and then given the vaccine. So that's your safety control gone forever. The fact that this trial existed at all is unbelievable. There are other issues in there which I haven't highlighted, but those are the key ones. Parents should be demanding that the decision makers explain themselves. I'm Dr.
So here is a pretty well-respected data scientist who really breaks down just a couple of the issues with the actual trial, which I, you know, again, I think we will attach to our podcast page, but on America Out Loud. But just the data in these tables, when I send them to some of my non-medical friends, and being non-medical, just people that are smart, a lot of them have probably graduate educations, and I just show them some of the tables on the results. They're astounded because of really just what we would call the vaccine efficacy in these is almost non-existent. It's negative in some of the time periods. Obviously, Claire there mentioned that some of, especially between the first and second dose, it seems like the likelihood of getting it went up precipitously in the vaccinated group. Additionally, the vaccinated were much more likely to get it twice during the time period. And obviously, the biggest question was, if you started out with 4,300, and by the end of the trial, you only have about 1,500 to 1,600, why did people drop out? Again, there is one answer to that, and that is that the original trial was for 2 injections, and then the FDA said, oh, let's try a third because the 2 injections were basically, you know, not helpful and completely kind of dumbfounded the immunological community on what the results were. It actually, the second injection in some of the younger kids, well, actually it was the 2 to 5 year old group that was their antibody levels did something that they didn't even expect. And again, when something like that happens in a trial, the last thing you do, to me at least, is double down and not step back and say, hey, this is not what we expected. Let's maybe rethink what our basic thought process is here. What do you think, Stuart?
Well, I think that this 4,300 down to 1,500 is an astounding reality that we have to grapple with in this respect. Could they have extended the trial just so that the washout of the bad outcomes would then afford them the opportunity to say there was benefit? You know what I mean? Could they have allowed that additional eight weeks to be included in the trial so that they could find a way, of course, it's all about deception for them, but to find a way to get the approval? I would not put it past these people. They have shown who they are, their character, their lack of desire for truth, their lack of desire for scientific rigor. They are running, flying this plane to the crash site as soon as they can get it there. And then we got to consider asking ourselves, why would they do that? That's a whole different discussion. But clearly, this deception in this trial, as Dr. Craig points out, they are embarrassing the Nazis, I would say. The Nazis of the Second World War.
Yeah, not only that, I mean, just when you just think of the fact that the placebo arm had half the people of the intervention arm, you know, of all the things it's easy to recruit, you know, it, you know, the placebo arm usually needs to be balanced, but it's just, it's funny to me. It must've been probably the number needed for the intervention to get it. But the fact is, just looking at the tables, I mean, the intervention group that got three was, 1,178, and the placebo group was 598. That's just kind of weird how that would happen. Vaccine efficacy on some of these, I mean, dose one, two before dose two, the vaccine efficacy was -29.7, which I don't know about you, but that's usually not that great.
Right.
And so that was why dose two to 7 days after dose two, it's still under 50%. And then greater than 7 days after dose two, it was 14%. So you can tell why the FDA said, hey, if we brought this as our statistical evidence of this thing works, I think people would have laughed them away. Instead, they kind of washed all that other, you know, dose one, dose two info off and went straight to dose three, okay? And basically, when you look at that, the vaccine efficacy is 75 to 82%, but you're talking about 3 versus 7. So 1 in the 6 to 23 month old age group to 2 in the 2 to 5 year old group in the intervention that got COVID versus the placebo, which was 2. So again, 1 to 2. So like literally one kid in the intervention group and two kids in the placebo group got COVID. And the other one was 2 to 5. And these were all after dose three. And I will remind you that dose 1 to 2 and 2 before 3, the efficacy was either non-existent, but most of the intervals there, if you can see, Stuart, are negative.
Yeah,
and
right.
even the negative, look at the vaccine confidence interval at the last, it says 75, but what do you find there in the confidence interval? A -370?
Right. You know, what's interesting about this whole, both of these, the whole study, if you want to consider it a study, they have moved so far past their brazen disregard for science compared to what happened a year and a half ago, or when they did the study for the EUA of the initially. They have so far moved past themselves in disregard for science and the scientific method. Why not publish any of this stuff? It doesn't matter what we publish and don't publish. The reality is we're going to get away with whatever we want to do. which to me is the astounding reality that we're all stuck in.
Yeah, to me, the fact that they can publish this and know that no one looks is probably an indictment of the process.
No, but they know we look, and what's going to be the repercussions of our looking at it?
Well, what I would say is the people that
right. I know what you're saying. Yeah, right. I understand what you're saying, but what will be the repercussions? Well, look at what happened to Dr. Peter McCullough and Dr. Corey, Pierre Corey, last couple of weeks. They're now investigating them. The American Board of Internal Medicine is investigating them. Why? Because they're looking at their own data, at these people's data. It's just an unbelievable paradigm. And once again, we invite those that are on the other side, that have been on the other side, don't back down. You don't have the option to back down. Go in and look at the data that we've been explaining the last 2 years and say, wait a minute, I've been wrong. I'm joining forces. I am, even though I am shamed, I'm ashamed of my past beliefs on this. It doesn't matter. This is too important. Get over yourselves. Join us in the fight.
Yeah. And we will be coming back here in a second to discuss some other things, because I think one of the things I'm about to discuss after the break is how it doesn't really matter what your credentials are when it comes to looking at data. And what I'm saying is you can find even somebody with a basic education that's outside of medicine. Statistics are statistics and numbers are numbers. And I think we're going to show how even a mom at home can actually force somebody to change their data at one of the top universities because they evidently missed some basic stuff that she knew, but they didn't. So we will be back. This is, again, Dr. Jordan Vaughn and Dr. Stuart Tankersley on America Out Loud Pulse, where we're always a beat ahead.
Here on America Out Loud, we emphasize optimal health, and air is the most essential element for life. The average person inhales over 35 pounds of air every day. Yet we seldom think about how to rid the air of pathogens swiftly and safely when we need to. The Genesis Fogger Plus HOCL is the only way to quickly and naturally restore air to its optimal condition. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud for a free ebook on everything you need to know about HOCL and receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next.
We wouldn't go a day without washing our hands, brushing our teeth, and washing our nose. Well, wait, we wash our nose? Yes, the number one place where bacteria, viruses, and pollen enter the body is through the nose. So the average person breathes over 23,000 times a day. That's 23,000 opportunities for bacteria, viruses, and irritants to get into your nose and make you sick. For an extra layer of protection, wash your nose with Clear. That is Clear, X-L-E-A-R. Clear's drug-free nasal spray features xylitol, an ingredient proven to block adhesion of many nasty bacteria and viruses, and effectively clean, not just rinse like a saline, but wash your nose. Clear nasal spray quickly alleviates congestion, opens your airway, and ensures your body's natural defenses are strong. Read the research studies for yourself at clear.com. That's X-L-E-A-R.com. Protect yourself from the pathogens and junk you breathe. Pick up a bottle for you and your family today.
So, as a mom at home, sitting there wanting to protect her children, the question a lot of moms, including my own wife, ask, Jordan, the corruption that's going on is so bad and so such a big issue, but what can I do? All my friends, Jordan, as my wife would tell me, all my friends, Jordan, they believe their pediatrician, they believe what's being said, they believe the news media, and they're just lining up to get something for their child. And here's the funny thing. She's like, Jordan, I know they care about their children. They don't. I mean, that's without question. That's, we all know that a mother cares for her child. So the question my wife has is, how do they get information from somebody to make an informed decision? And I think the next discussion we'll have is about really looking at some person. She's a mother actually in Georgia that's been following COVID-19 data. And over the last month, she has basically taken to task and had two large groups. One of these groups actually most recently included their data. Actually, the FDA and CDC included their data from a preprint that they had in the vaccine meeting they had last week. Some of the tables that this group had were included to basically point out that supposedly COVID was the fourth leading cause of death in children. And it didn't take long for this mom in Georgia, whose name is Kelly, to contact the author, thankfully through something like Twitter, and basically tell the author that he was using the wrong data set, and the data set he was using was not only not what he said it was, but it was implying something that was completely false. And I think this to me is an example of where if you have a brain that God gave you and you want to go and say something isn't really computing correctly, it doesn't mean, actually, I would say in today's time, it doesn't mean you're crazy. A lot of times, amazingly, with the sloppy science that's been going on for the last 2 years, you quite possibly could be correct because you're just evaluating it on what I would call basic math and numbers, not on ideology. So, Stuart, I think pointing this out was an interesting thing because what she did was called the author, and the author actually yesterday had to release out that he was updating his data after being pointed out that the data that he used, again, a slide from his preprint, was used in the vaccine and biological and the ACIP meetings on June 17th. And it was used to basically cause fear among people that the fourth leading cause of death in adolescents and children was COVID. The problem is, it was wrong. And not just a little bit wrong, but completely wrong. The other thing is when you're talking about ranking causes of death in children, one thing that you have to realize is the top issue for the cause of death in children, usually number one being accidents and other things like that, is usually, at least in this case, 25 to 30 times higher than a cause of death that may be number 4, 5, 6, or 7. And so rankings a lot of times are ways to get around the fact that the actual incidence of these things are extremely, if not infinitesimally, low. And I think that's where you have to realize that when somebody starts to use rankings, rankings aren't something that we use in children's, you know, making decisions about what to do for children. I mean, let's say number 4 was almost never happening and number 1 happened all the time. You wouldn't really care about number 4, meaning number 4 might still be on the list, but it's right. It's an interesting way to approach, especially in an emergency, approach something.
Yeah. This data, the absurdity of the children being at risk of this virus, I think everyone knows is not a potential. There is no potential for this. And I remember when Dr. Steve Kirsch, who is not an MD, but when Dr. Kirsch pointed out that I think it was 6 or 8 months ago that the children, not this age, but children had 114 times higher likelihood of being injured by the vaccine than dying from COVID. And so, and the younger you go, the better the chance of surviving COVID, of course. And we've known this, nothing new here. But for somebody 2.5 years into this whole ridiculous catastrophe to assert that it was a significant risk to children, clearly you would wonder what in the world. They certainly have a different agenda, which I think this is the first time I recall where an author, without being forced to, corrected themselves, which is a wonderful new development. And with that, I'll encourage people to reevaluate. Once again, if you've been on the other side of this fence, please join us in the fight. Don't let your shame of being wrong prevent you from taking the fight to these people who are trying to harm children nonetheless. I mean, it is amazing what's been going on. We thank you for joining us in this fight. But last week, there was an article about at one of the branches of University of California San Francisco hospitals where the radiologists, 75% of the radiologists were not getting the booster. Why? Because they were seeing the adverse events from these boosters and from these jabs that led to the main thing that they were seeing was blood clots in like the lungs and brains and things. But it certainly says to us that it certainly says to a lot of more people, something's gone terribly wrong. I've been on the wrong side of the equation. I'm going to keep my head down. At least some of them, I'm afraid, most of them are just saying, I'm going to keep my head down. I'm not going to engage. I'm not going to support the jab. I'm not going to buy into the lies, but I'm just going to keep my head down. We invite you to speak up because, and you can contact us through the America Out Loud Pulse podcast site. Please do. If you are a doctor or a provider that has been on our side of the fence throughout this pandemic and not buying into the lies, if you've been on our side of the fence and you've switched sides, please contact us because we've been seeking those people out and we cannot find one. We cannot find one person who's been on our side of the fence who's gone to the other side of the fence. Yet more and more and more doctors and providers are coming to our side of the fence. And our invitation is don't be ashamed. Join the fight because this is epic. This catastrophe is tremendously impactful, not just for today, negatively impactful for today, but for generations to come. And we want to encourage you to join the fight like this stay-at-home mom.
Who's this article? I mean, Jordan? She's obviously a mom, stay-at-home mom, but her background, I mean, she has dual majors from Emory in things that, you know, matter, meaning just ability to critically think and look at data doesn't, you know, that it doesn't require. And I will actually remind you, Stuart, I mean, I think this is funny when we talk about trials. When at the university setting, when I was at UAB, when we needed, you know, somebody to tell us how many people we needed in a trial, what was the, you know, what were the outcomes? Most of those people weren't physicians. In fact, none of them were. A lot of them were just biostatisticians. Okay. And that is a whole world that most physicians, I would say almost all physicians, unless they have a biostats background, are really, you know, complete, you know, they just take the numbers as they are. And the problem with those numbers is
right.
There is a lot to be said about the source of numbers is the most important thing. And then massaging data, which is kind of a word we use now, is used a lot. And it's usually requires somebody to evaluate your data that probably thinks different than you and probably even disagrees with you to really get the true, you know, the true finding, because we're all biased. And especially when we talk about people that from Pfizer to Moderna to now even the regulators, they've promised something. Okay. So that's the problem is when you have promised something as a solution and you're a politician, and the politician at this point would be any kind of executive body that has politicians at the end of it that can say or announce or tweet that they all of a sudden have the vaccine out and it's ready by Tuesday. Of course, it's such an emergency that we can wait. Again, it's not an emergency, but if it was an emergency, as they were saying, evidently we have to wait till Tuesday to get these vaccines out. Not that I would recommend that, but again, when they talk about emergency, the fact that take federal holidays into emergencies is kind of, I don't know if that would be counterintuitive, but I've never, I'm pretty sure during war times, we say, well, it's Juneteenth. Let's, you know, hold the bombing off and let's not fight each other till tomorrow. Is that what's going on right now in Ukraine, or do you think they're still fighting?
Yeah, they're still fighting. It reminds me of their duplicity when this whole fiasco started, the vaccine fiasco started in December of, of 20. What ended up happening was comical, we can say, in a lot of respects, because it rolled out on Monday, December the 21st. What did the bureaucrats in the Alabama Department of Public Health and their minions do? That's right. The following 2 weeks, they took four-day vacations because, dadgummit, Christmas and New Year's was not going to be impinged upon. So they rolled out the vaccine for 3 days. Then the following week, the last week of the year, they rolled it out for another 3 days. Everything went on halt. And then when the year started, they put it in full motion. But when I've been deployed, whether it was over Christmas or 4th of July or New Year's, we didn't just assume that we could stay in our tents and not worry about the enemy. But apparently, it would have been inconvenient, I guess, if we would have continued the fight. But that's what we ended up doing. But these people look at things a lot differently than the average person. Their evidence is clear. They don't care about
common
sense.
And I'm fairly certain, actually, not that I would recommend this, but during that time, I actually was going to my clinic, and even this past Christmas, and taking care of people, because evidently the virus didn't know it was a holiday either. Our skills, our training, our ability to take care of people and what we've been given by the Lord to do, also doesn't necessarily take a holiday. So it's just funny again, when we talk about, I think we discussed this last week, bureaucracies, are where people who are sacrificial go to die. There is no sacrifice when it comes to an institution. They are not interested in doing what's best for a person. They try to uphold their institution. And that really is kind of where a lot of times institutionalized medicine is, or what I would call nationalized healthcare or bureaucratic medicine, is so unfeeling and unpersonal and uncaring. Well, that's because it unfortunately is meant to be that way. It's the, well, can't take your surgery, can't do that, you need an emergency, but you know what, on the holiday, you've known this the whole year, Stuart, but you shouldn't have gotten appendicitis on the 24th, meaning it's...
Yeah, when I did OBGYN, I don't think at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, we put a sign on the door for all delivering mothers to just wait until 8 o'clock the next morning. We were on call 24/7. Yeah.
It's again, a misuse. I'll have to go back and check, but I don't think there has ever been, in this age group, something approved so hastily or, yeah,
nothing close to
at
this,
least
this
in the past, it could have been some cancer or something they might have done an EUA for some weird pediatric cancer. But even then, it was a significant disease or risk for a small subset of people that were experiencing it. Again, we really don't even have serological data on this age group. And the reason is because we really don't take blood from this age group very often. Unlike the 5 to 18 year olds where we know, well, about 5 to 11 year olds, we know that 80% of them have had COVID, which, by the way, that means that 80% of them are already protected better than these vaccines could offer them. But in this age group, we don't have that data. So we're running even blinder than we are in the 5 to 11 year olds. The emergency is less existent. The data set that's available to us about what's going on in this age group is smaller, and we are pulling out all the stops to give a vaccine or a biological product to this age group in, you know, unprecedented times during really, you know, just as our medical industrial complex is crumbling before our eyes.
Today we have been looking at why would we do this to our children and the absurdities that have led to the last week's acceptance of giving these jabs, these unproven and dangerous jabs to the most vulnerable among us. It is a stark reality we must accept. And those that have been on the other side that are not buying into the lies anymore, we invite you to get past your shame and your guilt of being wrong. Please don't, we're not here to point fingers at you anymore. We need you on our side. Please come along. You are obligated to joining us, I would say. And thank you for joining us. We'll be back after this meeting, after this break. This is Dr. Stuart Tankersley with Dr. Jordan Vaughn on America Out Loud Pulse.
While many things we hear are lies, we know one thing is true. Viruses exist and people get sick. Look, there's no guaranteed way to keep from getting sick, but there is a way to reduce your chances. Cofix RX, the original povidone iodine-based antiviral nasal spray that you hear Dr. McCullough talking about, provides an additional, invisible layer of protection from colds, flu, coronaviruses, and more. Click the banner ad on AmericaOutloud.com and use promo code OUTLOUD for 20% off. Stay protected with Cofix RX.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep can be infuriating. Your mind races. You toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's digital age makes it even harder. You're not alone with this struggle. Poor sleep affects over 70% of Americans. Even the Centers for Disease Control label insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. To take back your sleep, Healthy Cell has created REM Sleep, the only sleep supplement made to support all four stages of human sleep with calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support. Delivered in a patent-pending, pill-free, ultra-absorption microgel formula that tastes great. Fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM Sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Thank you for joining us again today and this week. You can always find us on America Out Loud Pulse. The platform is available, and you can go back and find all of ours, along with Dr. Singleton on Monday, Dr. Peter McCullough on Wednesday, Dr. Peter and his wife Ginger Bregan on Thursday, and Jack Weiler on Friday on America Out Loud Pulse. Thank you for joining us. And with that, last week, Jordan explained what brought me to this point in this horrible catastrophe we're all stuck in. And I would like you to share your experiences that have brought you to this point, to being a leader for concerned doctors. You can go to our website, concernedoctors.org. And Jordan, if you wouldn't mind sharing with the audience some things about yourself so that they will know who you are and can understand better why we're doing what we're doing. Thank you.
Thank you, Stuart. Yeah, so again, I am an internist. I'm younger than in this typical group. I'm actually about 10 years outside of my training. I finished residency in 2012. The thing that really brought me here is I've always been an independent guy to begin with, but in the last really 10 years, medicine has been under the assault of really being centralized and taken away from the people that have your best interest at heart, which would be why we call our group Concerned Doctors, is your doctors care and concern for you as an individual is really the foundation of medicine. It's really a interaction of what we call practicing medicine or the art of medicine. It is a lot of science, and science has really been a huge part of giving more credibility to medicine. But medicine's foundation is in the relationship between a patient and their physician. And that is kind of what I've always felt, mainly because my father was a physician, an independent physician who owned his own practice, who cared about his patients regardless of the interventions or oversight. It was always the patient first. And really, following biblically the golden rule, which was do unto others as you would have them do to you, which is kind of something we have always followed in my organization. So bringing that over the last 10 years as medicine has been assaulted really by the outside forces of really bringing our coalition of people, academic medicine, evidence-based medicine, corporate medicine, value-based care, all these fancy terms, as well as really, I mean, they sound good when you think about them, to have integrated care and, be able to have a computer or I think back in the day, it was a Watson, an IBM system that was supposed to be able to identify in your medical records all your problems that your doctor missed. It was to depersonalize medicine and make medicine something that is more, a formulaic and formula that if you're this age, if you have this, you get this. And the problem with that is that it does take away the interaction and the nuances that are you as a person, but also those interactions and nuances that give your doctor, your personal doctor, insight into what's going on with you. And I will again remind everybody, regardless of how much society wants to put us all in a age group, a sex, well, even sex is now questionable on their part, but age, sex, as well as risk factors, and come out with this is exactly who, Jordan Vaughn is and what his risk factors are. That is always going to be inadequate when we think about what is unique to that individual. And that is something that medicine has to get back to. So this assault has really been from the government. Obamacare really pushed in that direction. It pushed us in a place where most of the independent physicians, the physicians that were, had their own shingle out, or a group of physicians that really cared for their community, were unable to exist without, actually having a hospital system or the government come along and supplement the income because the regulatory burden became too great. And so what we see is now the outcome of this, which is what you've seen the last 2 years, where you're starting to go, the doctor you've seen for so many years is depersonal, is being told stuff, and he doesn't feel like that physician is telling you or being straight up with you. For some reason, there's somebody holding back what he really thinks, or you just feel like he's towing the party line. And I think that's put a fear in a lot of people, but especially in older individuals or people that really needed care in a time of need, were denied care because of a national narrative. And I think that is where we are today, and really what's brought our group together and pushed us toward trying to reestablish what is important about the patient-physician relationship and what medicine really is. Don't get me wrong, science, evidence-based medicine, scientific inquiry, new scientific advances, all these things are important for medicine, but they can't come at the expense of the individual. And I think that is currently what's happening. It's to the point that even as we were discussing in the previous segments, that the FDA and CDC combined with industry, so Pfizer and Moderna and BioNTech, are basically fundamentally changing the relationship of health and medical interventions away from a physician that knows you making decisions about what's best for you. Instead, it's a lot easier for them to get their product out to you and inject you without a physician who knows you answering questions. And I think you'll have seen this. I mean, it was kind of at the time we thought, well, that's just an easy way to get a bunch of injections out, to line them up in some stadium and have everybody put their arm out. But what you have to realize is that is an example of where the individual relationship you have with your physician is being compromised. So that is where I am coming from, is a physician that is independent, that owns his own practice, owns his equipment, owns his own pharmacies, owns his own buildings. What that allows me to do, and in the past, the reason for it was really for me to be able to do what I thought was best for my patients, which could be praying for them, which could be, making sure they were taken care of without payment, those kind of things. That flexibility really was something that my dad always taught me was important if you were going to make sure the best is done for the patient in front of you. Because when somebody else is controlling the pocketbook and what kind of things you have in your clinic, as well as your lease or all the above, once you come at odds with them, you risk the ability to make sure that your patient's taken care of. So that is kind of what established me to begin with. But in the last 2 years, that has been one of the most important things that has allowed me to step out and take a stand. And as much as I am somebody who has a great academic background, I have always been somebody that is skeptical of consensus. And I think that is something you will find even among our doctors that is pretty typical, which is a lot of times in science, in medicine, consensus is just a way for a lot of smart individuals to get together and have an opinion. And because that opinion is held by a bunch of preeminent authorities, and authorities I'll put in quotations, that consensus all of a sudden is considered fact. We call this logical fallacy, probably an appeal to authority. Well, what does the authority or expert say on this? And the reality is it doesn't really matter what the authority or expert says on this if they don't have evidence to back it up. And so that is a problem when we talk about what a Fauci or what a Walensky or these kind of individuals are doing. Because even when it's pointed out, just like we talked about in the last segment, that the data they're using or their information is incorrect, or they're being duplicitous, or what they're not saying is more important than what they're saying. The answer is, well, they are the CDC, or as Fauci likes to say, they are the science. And we've talked about this in a previous episode, that science is a way to investigate phenomena, investigate what's happening in front of us. No one possesses it. No one is it. And to say either of those things is to misunderstand or actually really have no idea what it means to say science. And I think that's what we've been seeing a lot with this appeal to authority, or what we would call technocratic progressivism. That's what's really eating away at our individual rights. When we think about what you want from your doctor when you walk in to see him, is you want him to think about you as an individual, think about your situation individually. And in all honesty, that's what's required by the physician. To do. You should expect him to do that. And these people, these technocrats, these bureaucrats, these administrative scientists are classic examples of people that think that the only problem really with medicine or with health or with the spread of disease, it's all because no one does exactly what they tell them to do. And if the world's problems would be solved, if they just listen to you or listen to this expert. And that's the problem. The problem is it's a fundamental misunderstanding of people and what exists in society. It's, you know, very rarely in history, almost never in history, has the expert provided the solution to a new problem. Experts are typically people that are very good at defining and elaborating on past phenomena. They are utterly awful at predicting the future, especially in something novel and new. Usually it's somebody who has not been contaminated with a consensus to think outside the box and come up with a solution that is really, you know, half the time it's they didn't even see coming. And that's what really we need to, I would say, give the, you know, how the biggest question, yes, is how do we produce that? How do we make the environment correct for the answer to be produced instead of the production of an answer? And what I'm saying basically is, instead of asking an authority to tell us what to do, instead allowing an authority that allows us to find out how to solve something. And I think that's where we've got to get back to. That's the foundation of what good medicine was. Interestingly enough, I think I've talked about this speech that Milton Friedman did before. And he is in 1978, he gave a talk to the Mayo Clinic and was talking about how the Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic, or other institutes like that, Johns Hopkins also, non-attached, non-hospital-based, institutions of medical learning and training. The only reason they exist today, and they're not associated with a specific university, is because they started prior to really the Rockefeller Institute and Abraham Flexner's report that basically put a lot of medical schools and hospitals per se out of business, and basically codified what medical schools were allowed to exist. And those medical schools a lot of times were under the purview of academic institutes that had fealty to the government or their, you know, funding sources. And so some of the greatest places and some of the places that come up with the most amazing interventions are places that only exist because they were founded prior to the government giving what, or the AMA, the American Medical College's accrediting board, before they were the really holders of a license or holders of a licensing committee or an accreditation committee for who could be a medical school and who couldn't. And that kind of basically is my fundamental argument, that our problem is when we decide who's allowed to speak, who's allowed to influence. And you're seeing that as well currently in the tech world. When we decide whose speech is worthy and whose is not, we are going to always miss out on something. And a lot of those somethings could be the answer. So that is really who I am. And I am hopeful that with our group in the coming years, as well as with platforms like America Out Loud Pulse that have provided us the ability to speak truth, to present data, to evaluate and critique the current narrative, that we will develop a group of physicians that desire is to do what's best for the patient and not to instead avoid really punishment from some type of, you know, state authority or licensing committee. Because when we treat our patients with the understanding that I can't do this because, you know, the Soviet commissar has said that you're not allowed to, we're really becoming a political body and no longer a scientific body. And so with that, I'm incredibly thankful for this show and what it means to be on America Out Loud Pulse, always a beat ahead. The doctors within this group and that you will hear during the week are really what I would call critical thinkers, people that don't take the, you know, the top line narrative, but instead look at it with the knowledge and expertise that they have to really see if what is being said is true and helpful to the people that they take care of and the people they influence every day. So with that, I will see y'all, me and Stuart, we'll see y'all next week. And I encourage each of you to again take a stand. Physicians, nurses, you know, nurse practitioners, PAs, pharmacists, demand that what we are broadcasting, what we are telling our patients, demand that it be what's best for them. And at the end of the day, if you do that, my father always said, you will never be without people seeking your wisdom. And I think that is what we have to get back to.